entrepreneur and French Quarter resident Sidney Torres is a crime victim, and he said his new advertisement being shown in New Orleans and Baton Rouge features upset Quarter residents and workers.
How many more shootings?
Enough is enough. Demand a plan from our mayor.
That is the need immediately to help with solving this crime issue in the French Quarter.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler, also writer and producer on CBS's Criminal Minds and the case of JonBenet Ramsey. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, advocate, analyst, and activist, and I'm founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also co-creator and co-producer of The Case of JonBenet Ramsey, and I'm calling in live from London via Skype.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes and the writers who write about those crimes. And we have a very special guest with us today. He is the author of the article that we're going to be talking about, Who Runs the Streets of New Orleans? And our guest is...
This is David Amston, a long-form magazine writer, and as mentioned... the author of the piece, Who Runs the Streets of New Orleans, for the New York Times Magazine, and I am calling in via Skype from Chicago.
So just to put this into context, we were approached by a sponsor to see if we wanted to get involved in a particular, actually a new type of sponsorship, and so we were asked to read an article about something that went on in New Orleans. Or Nolans, if you're down from there. Not New Orleans, as I was taught when I was a kid in New York to call it.
A TV show, yeah. A Fox TV show called APB wanted to be our sponsor, and they told us that they were doing it based on an article written by our guest, David Amston. And so we read the article, and it was just really a springboard for a lot of interesting conversations.
Absolutely, because... in my work with the FBI, I certainly did a lot of work around the city of New Orleans and in the state of Louisiana, as well as since then, I actually worked on a movie with Al Pacino and Sir Anthony Hopkins that was shot there. And during the course of that, I did note that in the French Quarter... there was a lot of need for extra security. The crime reports were very rampant, and there were a lot of people who worked on the crew that reported that a number of their productions that they worked on had extra security and that they had situations in which bad things happened while they were shooting.
What year was this, Jim?
This was 2015.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, David, how did you get involved in writing this article?
Well, I live in New Orleans, and I'm a relatively recent transplant. I had been spending long stretches in New Orleans for about the past 11 years and moved there 3.5 years ago. And I think, like a lot of people who move to New Orleans, especially in my case from New York City, which, you know, has really become kind of a model metropolis from a safety standpoint. You know, it hasn't always been that way, but for the majority of the time I lived in New York, you really would not think of being in danger when you were in incredibly popular, sought after, high, expensive neighborhoods. So New Orleans was a jolt, and I just became kind of fascinated with the crime aspect and what was going on. That was on, you know, a personal level, but being a journalist, those two often kind of overlap each other. And as this personal interest, you know, kind of deepened, this man, Sidney Torres, crime in the French Quarter was becoming a big issue. It always is in New Orleans, and it's always going to be because it's the crown jewel of the city. So any mugging there is probably going to be distorted in terms of how much coverage it's going to get and what it might mean and all the projections that people are going to, you know, put onto any crime that takes place there. But in my case, living right outside the French Quarter, it did fascinate me. It was the neighborhood I lived in, and it did worry me. And then this man comes along and does this project of essentially building a mini private police force within the public force that we'll talk more about. And it all just seemed like, you know, grist for something to explore.
Yeah, you know, I can't wait for you to describe the man we're talking about is Sidney Torres, and who, by the way, has his own reality show now. And he seems just like a larger than life character. He's an entrepreneur, very well known, I'm told, in New Orleans. And we have a listener who posts on Facebook. I'll just call her Miss Sandrine. And, you know, she was just giving me all the dirt on Sidney, on his background. But to you, so what is he like? I mean, you sat down with him. He took his money and he put his money where his mouth was and created this privately funded police force. And just tell me about that.
Well, I mean, one thing about a little background on Sidney, he's definitely a homegrown, you know, boy hero in a lot of ways to New Orleans. He's not actually from New Orleans proper. He's from St. Bernard Parish, which is just the next parish, which is our word for county down in New Orleans over. And he kind of came to fame, I guess you would say, is he was a real estate developer and a hotel developer. And after Katrina, when the trash pickup hadn't resumed, he rented a truck and started picking up some trash for his hotels and his properties, and other people contracted him out. And he is just a self-described serial entrepreneur. If he sees a small idea will quickly become a big one. And, you know, one thing led to another and he became, quote unquote, the trash king of New Orleans. He started a company, SDT Management. They were and still are a very huge company in Louisiana and elsewhere. And he sold that company a number of years ago. I can't quite remember, say somewhere within the past 5 years, for quite a bit of money, all of which led him to, he was developing a property in the Bahamas. And I think he hadn't spent as much time in New Orleans. And when he came back after finishing up this Bahamas project, and first he's seeing some of these reports about crime in the French Quarter, and mind you, he lives on Esplanade Avenue, which is one of the bounding streets of the quarter and a very iconic and beautiful street in the city. And his house was robbed and they stole a TV of his. And I think he felt what a lot of people feel, which is, how can this be happening? The difference was he had a large bank account. And so he started taking out ads on TV attacking Mitch Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans, saying he wasn't being tough enough on crime. And in one of the very fascinating things about New Orleans as opposed to bigger cities is you can have these kind of spats between a citizen and a mayor where the whole city kind of starts watching in curiosity, which is what happened with this. And these ads come on, and then, of course, the mayor has to comment on them. And one of the mayor's comments was, if he thinks it's so easy, why doesn't he put his money where his mouth is?
And there's probably the last thing he expected was for him to actually step up and do it, right?
I don't know. In New Orleans, I don't think people are shocked by much. So it's probably not what he expected. But to be honest, I don't think he was probably shocked. Just things happen organically in New Orleans in a way that they just do not happen elsewhere. And I think this is just an extension of some of that.
I was just going to ask, you mentioned in the article that he had a nickname, that he was called Trashanova.
That was one of the nicknames. Yep.
And obviously, I mean, the work that he did in terms of clearing up, but why Trashanova? I mean, is there a backstory there?
He is a flashy man. He is a good looking man. He is very deft at self-promotion. So although he was working in an industry that could basically not be less glamorous, waste management, right. He enlisted celebrities like Kid Rock and Lenny Kravitz to be in his ads. And he had his trashmen. They were always wearing kind of like tight black t-shirts.
Get out of here. Are you kidding?
You gotta love it. Oh. Lisa, you gotta love it.
No, I do.
He had the vehicles were these matte black Polaris Rangers that kind of look like a kind of cross between a golf cart and an ATV.
Wait, but this was for the police. This was not for the sanitation. This
no,
was for the police.
They were.
No, it started with the sanitation. Yeah. Same vehicles.
Oh, my God.
How did he carry trash in those little vehicles, though?
Well, in terms of with the quarter, when you're trying to go around, I mean, one thing with Sidney is he's a perfectionist and he is incredibly detail oriented. So his kind of thinking was, he had the big traditional trucks too. And even those were always, you know, black, matte black or glossy black with his very slick white logo. So it didn't look like what you're used to seeing. He kind of made trash glamorous. He made it a reflection of himself. And that's
quite
kind
a skill to be able to do that.
Oh, he has a lot of just incredible instincts when it comes to branding and promotion.
That's awesome.
You know, I'll give him that.
But here's my question. Why not give all of those resources to the police themselves? Like a lot of companies do that. The police can have, you know, grants and all different kinds of resources from outside companies. Why not work with them instead of setting up something that's separate?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And, you know, as we talk more, we can really get into some of this because it's by no means a non-controversial issue. And I think it raises a lot of questions, and none of them are very easy. In the case of Sidney, it ultimately was a partnership and continues to be a partnership between him and the city, where essentially what he did is he built a mobile app that is, you know, for shorthand is kind of like Uber for cops. If you see something going on, you can summon a policeman. These policemen are not, while Sidney originally was paying the salaries for them, they are NOPD officers who are reporting through the 8th Precinct, which is the French Quarter precinct. So it was essentially, he was kind of giving this, he licensed this app to the city for free. He bought them these Polaris Rangers, which he has since updated to smart cars, and paid the salary because the city doesn't have any money right now to pay for these cops. So it was this interesting and frankly, I think pretty ad hoc partnership between the city and Sidney. I think for Sidney, which is the case with a lot of people who have money, is he can act on impulse and get things done. You know, for him, there isn't a whole lot of bureaucracy. He doesn't need to meet with 100 people to do something. If something costs $500,000, well, he's got that. So his take was like, look, I'm going to do this. I can do this. I don't want to have 3 years of meetings. Something needs to be done right now. And I think the city's response was, why do we want this to be contentious? Let's figure out a way to make this a partnership. And I think that's, you know, I wrote this story about a year and a half ago. It continues to unfold in New Orleans. I mean, it's a total experiment, it's a work in progress.
So this was a pilot originally, was it? And
yeah.
Like you said, I mean, it's still going on. So was the pilot evaluated or what happened for it to then be rolled out as a success and for it to continue?
I think the first stage was, Sidney was putting up enough money. I believe it was right around $500,000 to fund this thing for whatever, 2 or 3 months, whatever it was. And some kind of evaluation, which was based on, you know, do people like this? Are people downloading the app? Is it working? Is there tension between this and the NOPD, or is it working in sync? Mind you, there's a whole other component to this too, which I mentioned in the article, which is also that the state police have been summoned into the French Quarter. This, it really went into triage effect. So you now have the NOPD, Sidney's task force, and the state police all using the same system and responding to the same crime. So they wanted to say, hey, is this working? The consensus was, yes, it's working. We need to extend this. Okay, where's the money come from? In this case, it came from the Tourism and Business Bureau. I can't remember the exact name, but they came together, earmarked some money to fund it through the rest of the year with the city saying, okay, we'll figure out a way to keep funding this. And frankly, it remains very much, is this going to last? Is this going to go for another year? Where's the money going to come from? Sydney's not going to pay for it indefinitely. I know he's continued to chip in when they need it.
So who oversees all three of these forces? I mean, that's the thing that is so confusing to me. Like, and who sets their priority on what, on where they go to? I mean, if everybody is logging into this app, there's got to be somebody dispatching, like, where the resources go, right? I don't know anything about law enforcement, so please, you know, jump in, guys. But
yeah, I don't know a ton about it either in terms of, you know, how, well, I do know a fair amount about how it's run, but in the case of that, I can't totally compare it. I don't know exactly how the NOPD or the state police do it, but it is a very interesting question, and I know there have been issues. Essentially, they're all getting the same calls, which is not unlike if you just have a police force. A call will go out, and whoever's closest, you know, oh, okay, here, you know, I've got this, I'm proceeding. So that's what happens when you have the state police, you've got Sydney's task force, you have the NOPD. If there's a call, there's been a suspicious activity, there, you know, there's been a stabbing, there's been a shooting, you know, if it's something of, you know, if it's like a shooting, I think they're all going to respond when it's something of that priority. Otherwise, I think they divvy it out pretty quick. In the NOPD 8th District, there is a room dedicated to the task force. And I think the idea there is to, you know, bring this task force into the NOPD as a whole, so there isn't a whole, so they're not stepping on toes, but figuring out ways to work in tandem.
Right. And I think, you know, normally in the dispatch process, there is an immediate response by anybody who is taking the call, and then they become sort of the point person. They are then communicating with other people, whether they need backup or not, where they actually are, what they actually observe. And that is a critical part of the process. Do they have that back and forth with this app, or is it a one-way communication and that's it?
When you say one-way communication, do you mean between the actual human being reporting something suspicious and the officer in the car?
Correct.
Well, I think part of it is, no, I mean, when that person is reporting, oh, I'm seeing something suspicious, it's popping up on the dashboard of these officers on patrol, and it's also popping up on the, you know, home screen of these people in the precinct. So they're having a communication while they're en route to that, but they can respond very immediately.
Wow, this has been a really great discussion, and when we come back from the break, we will continue.
Not one person can do this. We need everyone to do it. Like the mayor said, it needs to be a group.
The mobile application is designed to help people in the French Quarter quickly alert 3 paid detail NOPD officers that will be patrolling the quarter in these Polaris patrol vehicles and respond to crimes reported throughout the application.
So now we're back, and we're continuing our discussion.
I think, you know, to step back for a moment, one thing that's important to understand about New Orleans is there's been a really intense atrophying of the police force over the past 10 years. The numbers are just not where they should be. And for a long time, they're working to reverse this, but essentially they've been losing about 100 officers a year. So you have this force that is just getting depleted and depleted and depleted. So some of what you're used to seeing in cities with, you know, bigger and more functioning municipal budgets are very simple things. You know, if you walk around Times Square, you'll see police officers just standing on corners that doing their job. In New York now, there's something like between 30 and 40,000 officers. So you have this proactive police force. In New Orleans, where you had at times, you know, 400 officers on duty for a city of 350,000, also a city with some of the highest crime rates in less tourist trafficked areas, you just did not see a lot of police in the quarter. And I think the most important thing, or one of the most important things that this experiment has given people, is a sense that police are nearby.
Yeah, one of the things that you quote in your article is that the average response time in the quarter is like 26 minutes when this program started. And that seems to be incredibly, incredibly slow. And I think it's probably due to what you were saying, the attrition of the police force.
But what's the reason for that drain? I mean, why is that?
That's a complicated question, too. If from everyone I talked to, they pointed out a couple of things. One, people mentioned kind of PTSD from Katrina. There was a lot of police officers who were responding during that time saw a lot of things. There were a lot of controversial clashes between citizens and cops. New Orleans has a long history of tension between its police force and its citizens. A lot of what we're seeing in other cities and what has become a national discussion has been a local discussion in New Orleans for decades. And a lot of this kind of came to a head after Katrina. But also you just don't have money. And there was in 2010, so that's one point. 2010, Mitch Lindrew put a hiring freeze and a salary freeze on the police. So that led a lot of officers to look for work elsewhere. They went to neighboring parishes. They just wanted to go where they could get raises and also work in safer places. Also, what Mitch Lindrew did is he did an agreement with the government, a consent decree, to essentially have the federal government overseeing the New Orleans police force. And we're seeing something similar in this in Baltimore right now. I think that created, so, you know, you combine Katrina, a consent decree, which has the potential to send a message to the officers of, we don't think you're doing your job that well, so we're going to have the federal government babysit, plus a hiring freeze, does not create a great sense of morale. The police commissioner, Michael Harrison, when I interviewed him, he admitted, you know, morale was at a low, and they're working on improving that. But I think at the very least, those are three things to look at: the effects of Katrina, the effects of a hiring freeze, the effects of a consent decree. They definitely jolted the force, and I think made it less appealing.
So one of the reasons why that consent decree occurred, though, is the history of corruption in the government and particularly in the police department in New Orleans. Are you aware of any of that? Because
Absolutely. Oh, it was long overdue. I mean, in my opinion, I am not a law enforcement expert. You know, I'm a journalist who goes wherever I get curious. So this did become a topic over the past couple of years for me. But yeah, I mean, the New Orleans policing history is not one, definitely has some very dark chapters getting us right up into the present day. So I think this was something that was overdue, something that will ultimately produce a more functional police force. But part of the growing pains is less officers on the street right now.
Right. And I know that when there was a period of time, and Laura and I have looked at many of these cases, there was a period of time where three different serial killers were operating in that area. And in one in particular case, where they eventually did catch the guy, I believe there were nine victims of this particular killer, that before they even decided that there was actually a serial killer out there, and some of the victims, it was just glaringly obvious that they were sort of not, they didn't really care.
And bodies were appearing, you know, in places that people could see them, and yet there was no real proactive investigation or anyone caring, as Jim said, that young men were being killed and bodies were turning up.
And I think some of them happened to be gay, and I think that added to it. I think there was a tremendous disrespect for the victims. And one of the things we try to focus on Real Crime Profile is the victim's perspective. And I remember when that case came into the behavioral analysis unit at the FBI when I was working there. And I remember it being like just shocking at the numbers. I think in the end,
it's like 23 victims for this one guy.
23 or 29, maybe. And yeah. he was not a big guy. He was not very imposing. He used his small stature and he used his sort of meek style to actually lure people in, and also to when people were looking at him as a possible suspect, to sort of defray some of the suspicion, because he didn't look like a monster serial killer that he actually was.
And he wasn't criminally sophisticated either, so it wasn't as if he was intentionally being able to hide or dupe law enforcement. There just seemed to be no real will or desire to proactively investigate or certainly link these cases. And in fact, it was in a show called Killer Profile that aired in 2013 that two of the cases that Jim and I covered with someone else called Jim Fitzgerald.
That we actually brought to light some of the things that went on that had never been really covered before. So anyway, I'd be interested in your perspective on that, about what was going on in the police department. I know they also had situations in which some corrupt police officers were actually, doing hits and helping out gangsters and drug dealers and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I am not a scholar on the New Orleans police force. You know, I can say what I will say is anecdotally is there's a sense on the part of the citizenry that the police are not so engaged. You know, you hear stories very, very common. You know, I can walk through my neighborhood, talk to a neighbor, he'll point to a house and say, oh yeah, I remember when cops were selling drugs out of that house. They'd confiscate it from the dealer here and then go sell it there. Now, I'm not saying this to point a finger to the NOPD. You know, there's a place where truth and myth can start to braid together. And I think New Orleans, that tendency is particularly acute. But, you know, what I will say is, you know, which is essentially repeating what has been out there from, you know, when the mayor announced the consent decree years ago is, you know, this is a force that needed, it needed to be combed over. It needed to be retooled. And they're in the process of doing that. You know, you would need to get someone else who could really speak at length highlighting, you know, various issues.
Yeah. But the point is that they have been operating under the consent decree for a time now, and they have actually been improving, but at the same time, they've been losing their numbers, losing their ranks, and so that puts added pressure and takes away resources that the city actually really needs. So I'm not blaming the police department any further for this situation. I'm saying that the fiscal realities are that they don't have enough cops to police this city, especially the areas of the city that are very poor. And I think that's one of the issues that your article brings up is that, you know, the fact is that Torres was wealthy enough to say, I will fund this myself and kind of kickstart this process. What my question is has this process now spread from the quarter to sort of the outlying regions, the outlying parishes that probably suffer more crime, but aren't as high profile?
Well, I think that's a question that I think people are still asking. If you're talking about some of the areas of where there's some real endemic crime and some real endemic poverty, of which, you know, there a lot of New Orleans falls under that description. You know, I can't say for sure. You know, I don't live there. I don't report on this all the time. Is the police presence there beefed up? What I have noticed is in the neighborhoods just around the French Quarter, you know, in the business district, which is also a pretty wealthy, very wealthy neighborhood by New Orleans standards, the Marigny and Bywater, which are kind of transitional gentrifying neighborhoods, you start to see a couple more cops now, a couple more places where they're just perched. Is that because there's now some, you know, added Sidney Torres manpower in the French Quarter to free up a couple of patrols where they didn't have them? Maybe. Or is it also just part of the NOPD, you know, constantly trying to figure out something better to do? But there's definitely been a little bit of a shift. I mean, things are very slow moving in that city. And I think when it comes to law enforcement, they should be. You know, I don't think you want to get, you know, be drastic. I mean, equally, as much as the Sidney Torres thing has been a change to the French Quarter, and you see these cars zipping around, the presence of the state troopers with their white trucks is also not to be downplayed. When you've got those guys in, especially on the, you know, weekends or during a big event like a college football game, the presence in the French Quarter is so beefed up that inherently you start to feel and see more cops around. I mean, when I first moved to New Orleans 3.5 years ago, the joke was you never saw a cop. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were outside, especially if you're outside of the French Quarter, you just never saw them, you know. And now I would say that's changed. Has it changed citywide? I can't answer that. And I suspect the answer is no.
Is your sense that, you know, that crime has gone down and certainly major crime or things that people fear, you know, within communities, that there has been a reduction over the last couple of years?
No, not at all. You know, I think here's, you know, if I, and whether this is me being, I don't mean to criticize when I say this, but what I think has changed the most, if we're talking about since Sidney Torres instituted this in the French Quarter. I think that residents of the French Quarter and neighboring areas, I think they do feel more safe. I think you're hearing them complain less about crime. Look, there were two very prominent shootings in the French Quarter in December. It is a popular tourist neighborhood. There's always going to be activity. But you don't hear people talking about it as much. It doesn't make the news with as much the same kind of alarmist bent. I think by some numbers, before we chatted, I was looking around. You will find a criminologist in New Orleans who will tell you that crime in the French Quarter is going up, and you will find one telling you that crime in the quarter is going down, and they will analyze the same stats and come to different conclusions. So it's almost like take your pick.
The same with the broken windows theory as well, isn't it? I mean, I've listened to so many different people talk about that, of whether it's a success, whether it's not. And you're right, people can use those things and stats and crime data to what they want the picture to be and the narrative to be.
Right. I mean, in terms of the city as a whole, New Orleans is a city with a crime problem. That's not going, they're trying, but as far as I can tell, no, it's not going anywhere. If I'm not mistaken, and I don't believe I am, there were more murders in New Orleans in 2016 than there were in 2015. So that's not great. But I think in the core neighborhoods, yeah, there's a deeper sense of safety.
So we're going to take a quick break, David. And when we come back, I have a quote from your article that I want to ask you about and talk about. So we will be right back.
Torres, who is also a French Quarter resident, put up his own money to help fund the project and says he wanted the application to be simple to use.
You want anybody that is not really technology savvy that can get on there and operate it.
Okay, and we're back talking with New York Times writer David Amsden. So, David, I have a quote from your article, okay? And I'm not going to be able to do the accents very well, Cher, so just bear with me. But we have Sidney saying, looking at his, he telephoned a member of the dispatch team, and he's like, we have a possible gunfight on St. Louis. What's going on, man? We have a guy en route. I see that, but he needs to step on it. Now, when I read this seemed like such bullshit to me. Why is this entrepreneur calling the shots on? I mean, doesn't this seem like overstepping things to you guys? I mean, Jim, Laura, please. I mean, is this like ridiculous?
Well, I mean, it's so simply a situation where he's very self-interested in this. I mean, this is in his neighborhood, so he wants it to be dealt with. I think that is a problem. If you let the people that live there and the people with money decide who and what crimes get the most attention, I think that is fraught with a lot of problems.
But getting there fastest isn't the only thing that a police officer does, right? That's not the only thing to police work. I mean,
no. And that's why I asked about the interaction, because was there an update from this person? Did that get dissipated? Did they move four blocks over? And is he now traveling away from where the problem is? I mean, there's things that I would, as a law enforcement officer, I would like to know when I was riding into this situation. And when I read that part of your article, David, I really felt like, is Torres sending this guy to his death? I mean, it sounds like he's being irresponsible. I mean, he's sending one guy into a situation where you have multiple people. You already have information that guns were brought out. So what, is he really prepared to get and deal with this alone?
Well, this conversation is exactly why I wrote the article. I mean, I wanted to try to tell the story of something that was going on in New Orleans to get people asking, exactly these questions. Should the rich be able to decide, where police work, and should they be able to control them with this way? Now, in terms of to answer some of the stuff in more specifics, in the case in this article, Torres is calling in to the dispatch booth, which is in the NOPD precinct. This guy who is working, he is essentially, he is a city employee working overtime as a policeman doing this patrol work. So just as the same as if he were on foot or in an NOPD cruiser and you get a call that says there's a man with a gun on St. Louis, what are you going to do? You're going to just, okay, I'm en route. I'll tell you what I see when I get there. Sydney is just watching this on his phone, and because there's a, you know, 2 or 4 second delay in the GPS, he's wanting to see it solved faster. You know, it was definitely something, you know, that's the lead of my story. And part of the reason I highlighted that moment is it just kind of went to show his involvement. And it also, of course, you know, can bring up a lot of questions like this, which, you know, I don't think have easy answers.
Yeah. I just wonder if he's as excited about like a call for domestic violence. I mean, that's the first thing, Laura, that I thought of is like, are they rushing to these kind of calls, or is it just, you know, robberies and burglaries and things that are threatening the commerce?
They are responding to calls that are reported by not only, but through users of this app, which of course is not necessarily going to be directly related to the commerce in the French Quarter, but it's unlikely in terms of, let's just say, domestic violence. You know, if a woman who is, you know, dealing with an abusive spouse is probably not going to sign on to this mobile app and try to report this more than she would try to call 911. But who knows? Will that change? You know, I don't know. The point is, when these guys get a call on this app, they respond to everything. And just like all police work, a lot of the stuff are false alarms or, you know, pranks, all sorts of things. You know, I know they end up just responding. You know, someone will say, you know, like, oh, there's a suspicious guy on corner X, and it'll turn out to be a licensed street musician playing the fiddle, and they, you know, the cops are annoyed. At least what Sydney's program in essence does, since they have these smaller, nimbler vehicles, is they can get there and check that out within just a couple of minutes without having to take, you know, a squad car off the streets that, you know, right, could be being dispatched to a murder or could be being dispatched to that domestic abuse case.
Right. And that's why I was mentioning it about this situation. When there's a report that there's a crowd of people and guns are out, to send one person in an unprotected vehicle alone into this situation, I think, is irresponsible policing. And I think, you know, the FBI agents rarely get killed. There's in 100 years, I think there was a total of about 50. And that is because when we respond to a situation where there's danger, we go with overwhelming show of force. And I think sending one guy in a golf cart, it would be very easy to take him out. He's got no protection at all of the vehicle around him, and he may be being sent to his death. And even if he is a trained police officer, I think in this particular case, they should have shown up with 3 or 4 cars at the same time, especially with all these people. And in fact, what ended up happening was they let them run away because only one guy with a golf cart came. They let them get away, and those people then were free to go and hurt somebody else again. And so I do not think that was the right way to respond to this. And Torres's, insistence that this guy get there immediately alone, I think that could have created a problem in this particular case. You certainly didn't arrest anybody because of that. And now the community has these people who have, quote, gotten away with waving guns and fighting in the streets.
Yeah, well, that's I'm not an expert in, you know, law enforcement response and tactical response techniques, you know, but I do think what you bring up is something interesting, which is, you know, almost a metaphor for this whole experiment, which is it maybe moving too fast in terms of just wanting to see a certain kind of result and not asking some of the deeper questions of how this should be executed and what are some of the more endemic and systemic problems that led us to this place. I mean, I think everyone in New Orleans, including most people in law enforcement, would say the ideal in that situation is someone calls about a gun on a corner in the French Quarter and you have four squad cars there within a minute. That's just not happening in New Orleans today. That is not the case of New Orleans in 2015, 2016, 2017. So then you have to ask the question, okay, do you do no response because all you have is a guy in a golf cart that could get there in 3 minutes, or wait, you know, 10 minutes for those, you know, eight cops to potentially show up at which point.
Or does he turn off his blue flashing light so that he can then get to a point where he can now report to the police department what's actually going on, and then they can show up in force. He can actually be the eyes and ears of the police department and actually do some surveillance and determine whether this is a street vendor who's juggling or it's actually somebody who's causing or about to cause, you know, serious physical injury or death. And I think that, I just would have eliminated that blue light, and then you may have been able to arrest the person who had the gun as opposed to letting them run off because they saw that blue light two blocks away.
I mean, I think this is the true, issue around law enforcement, full stop, wherever you are in the world, you know, whether it's in the UK, whether it's in the US, about accountability and about your priorities. And, you know, there are lots of police services that are measured on the wrong things. And the same with any emergency services, paramedics, ambulance service, where they're measured on response times. And that's everything about accountability. And law enforcement, I do believe, should be run like a business, and there should be accountability, and technology should play a key part as well. But it really does matter about the training. And certainly, you know, crime fighting with the right attitude and technology have to go hand in hand. And the intelligence and the local dynamics on the street as well are equally important. I say that with an intelligence background. So it's quite hard. I mean, Lisa, reading that quote about him saying, you know, it's about the response time. Well, actually, yes, that is part of it. But you do want somebody who understands policing and policing the streets and has knowledge, as well as the business end of intelligence. And I think policing is very complex now, politically too, as well as in terms of business and money. And certainly in the UK, we do have a situation where we have less and less police officers too. And normally they're single crewed when they go out. There are no easy answers, I don't think. But when we live in a digital age where we order Uber, we order everything via an app, right, why too shouldn't there be an element where law enforcement get the best technology to help them? But I think it's not, you know, it's a case of and rather than or. So I think this is a very interesting sort of experiment. But, you know, money does play a key part. Who finances it? Should it be a private individual? Well, that feels wrong, you know. But we've got UK police forces right now that are being funded, 80% of them, by external money coming in. So sometimes here people are paying double for a service. They're paying their taxes and then they're paying privately too, but there's no one individual paying for that. So, you know, I think this is interesting with one single individual sort of calling the shots, and clearly he's enjoying that element to it as well. And you've met him, so you would know more about his psychology. But I think accountability is really key, and risk and intelligence and all the things that I've mentioned.
All right, so we have a lot more to talk about, but before we do, does anybody have any recommendations?
I wanted to recommend a couple things that you can find on YouTube, because we're going to have an upcoming podcast all about New Orleans crime. There's one thing to watch. You should watch Killer Profile, which is actually a show that Jim and Laura and Jim Fitzgerald did, and they cover some serial killers that were active in New Orleans and Louisiana area. You should definitely check that out. And there's another one called The Mystery of the Bayou Blue Serial Killer. It's an amazing documentary on YouTube, and it really comes from the victim's family's point of view. This documentary goes into their homes and gets very raw interviews from the people who were affected by a serial killer that operated in their community for years before he was captured. And so I really encourage you to check those out.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I want to recommend a series of books by a former Georgia Bureau of Investigation agent named Merle Temple. He's an amazing author and has become a great friend of mine after I read his first book, Ghostly Shade of Pale. I was really struck by the descriptive nature of this and his intense knowledge of crime and criminal behavior and corruption. And it's just amazing. So if you're into crime novels, this is an amazing book. And most of it is based on actual experience on the part of Merle Temple. So he's got He's written three other books after that, but start with Ghostly Shade of Pale. Great title, even greater book. So thanks for listening to Real Crime Profile, and tune in next week to listen to the continued conversation with David Amston.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.